People want to be seen as muscular, strong. And in the spiritual realm, there's the same feeling. We want to be known as people with strong faith. Our faith is unwavering, and we're not going to be knocked by whatever comes. The question is, what does a strong faith look like in the Bible? How do God's people display faith in the Bible? Well, as you read the Bible, you find that the people of God come to God with turmoil as well as serenity. They come with perplexity as well as assurance. They come with complaints as well as thanksgiving. They come with questions as well as certainties. And you can look at characters like Abraham, Gideon, Job, many of the psalmists, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Habakkuk, and even Jesus. You think of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he's struggling with what's ahead. And he says, Lord, isn't there another way? Father, isn't there another way? Nevertheless, your will be done. And then as he's hanging on the cross, he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? So all through the Bible, you see this assurance and perplexity, certainty and questions. And Habakkuk is someone who was baffled by God not doing anything. And so we saw 2 weeks ago, his question is, how long? How long are you going to be silent, not doing anything? Why are you not doing anything? And then God answers him. And that makes things even worse. He's even more baffled by what God says to him. It's as if the cure is worse than the disease. And so, in this second half of chapter 1, we want to see how Habakkuk engages honestly with God. He has confidence in God, but there's a questioning of God. So, first of all, his confidence in God. And you see that in verse 12. Some people have seen Habakkuk as an example of weak faith. And even the great Christian leader, Martin Luther, he felt that Habakkuk was someone with weak faith. I don't see that. I see that he was somebody with real, strong faith. You see, a person with weak faith doesn't express their doubts to God. They express their doubts to other people. That's a person with weak faith. They have all sorts of problems in their mind and they talk about it with other people. But they don't come to God and engage with God. But that's what Habakkuk does. He engages with God with his questions. We see the solid foundation to Habakkuk's faith. First of all, that God is eternal. O Lord, are you not from everlasting? He is the solid rock whose character and plans are unchanging. There's turmoil, but God's character is unchanging. He is eternal. Just look at Psalm 46, verse 1 to 3. God is our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though the waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging. Here's the psalmist. He's saying everything around is collapsing. There's turmoil. But our hope is in God, who's our rock, who doesn't change. He's eternal. Secondly, he believes that God is a covenant God. And in your Bible, you probably have Lord in capital letters. That translates Yahweh, the saving God, the God who makes a covenant with his people, the God who's committed to his people. And Habakkuk knows that about 100 years before, The northern part of the kingdom, Israel, had been totally annihilated, the people taken away by the Assyrians. And so he's wondering, is that going to happen to Judah, the southern kingdom? Are the Babylonians coming and we're going to be totally annihilated? And his confidence is, no, God will not let his covenant people be destroyed. And so he says, we will not die. My God, my Holy One, we will not die. That's his confidence. God never lets go of his people. And then thirdly, God is the sovereign God. God rules over the nations. And so he says, O Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment. You have ordained them to punish. And we were seeing 2 weeks ago that Nebuchadnezzar, the great ruler of the Babylonians, is called the servant of God. And the great ruler of the Persians, Cyrus, he's called God's anointed one. God is using them, even as they carry out their own plans, God is using them to fulfill his plans. Proverbs 21, verse 1 says this, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. He directs it like a watercourse wherever he pleases. The king makes his decisions, but God uses those decisions to carry out his purposes. And when you read the book of Daniel, you see the great rulers of Babylon, the great rulers of Persia, but what stands out is that God is in charge. It is heaven that rules. The same message comes across in Revelation. In all the turmoil and chaos in our world, it's the Lamb who's on the throne, Jesus, who is ruling. Now that's what is the foundation to Habakkuk. God is eternal. God has made a covenant with us, and he is totally committed to his people. And God is the sovereign. And so I'm safe in his hands. And so even as we come with our doubts and questions and turmoil to God, we need to remind ourselves of our rock-solid foundation. That's what we do when we pick up our Bibles and read about God. We've gone through a week where things have been difficult and things are in turmoil, and we pick up our Bible and we're reminded, this is what God is like. This is our foundation. That's what we do when we come together on a Sunday and we sing hymns about God, of praise to God, and we look at what he is like. We're reminding ourselves of our rock-solid foundation. And we need to do that because in the week we're battered by all sorts of opinions, what people say about God. And doubts begin to creep into our mind, and we begin to struggle. And we need to be reminded again of our rock-solid foundation. Well, then Habakkuk comes to questioning God, and he is appalled. He is appalled at what God has just told him. First of all, that God can be associated with evil. Verse 13 says, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? You see, the idea of God being pure and absolutely without any trace of anything wrong, anything sinful, was hammered home to the Israelites. So that when they made the tabernacle, all the utensils had to be of pure gold because they're coming to a God who is pure. All the priests had to have garments that were pure. They went through a special ceremony to wash themselves and then put on these pure garments because they're coming to a God who is pure. And we read of two of Aaron's sons who offered up incense unauthorized fire, we're told, and God strikes them down dead. They were to learn that God is absolutely pure. He doesn't tolerate evil. And so how can God be associated with an evil people like the Babylonians? That's what he says to Habakkuk. When Habakkuk comes with the question, why aren't you doing anything? And God says, I'm doing something. I'm raising up the Babylonians. I'm going to use them to judge my people. And Habakkuk is shocked. How can you, a pure God, use evil people? So he's appalled. Just look at the intense evil of the Babylonians. They were more evil than the people of Judah. And so in verse 13, why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? The people of God were bad, but the Babylonians were even worse. So how can you use people who are even worse to bring judgment on your people? They were greedy and cruel. So that verse 14 and 15 talk about them being like fishermen who throw out their net and they pull in the net of the nations. And they go from one nation to the next and they throw in their net over that nation and they pull them in. And they use fish hooks to catch the people. Now the Assyrians were also cruel, and they had a practice of putting hooks into the lower lips of people that they'd conquered, and they would lead them away as captives with this hook in the lower lip. And that's what the Babylonians did. As they led people away to captivity, they would have hooks in their lower lip to lead them away. And they are proud and boastful in their gathering of their wealth. Look at verse 16. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet, for by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys the choicest food. He's proud about what he achieves. He's conquered all these nations. He's gathered their wealth together. And so he worships himself, worships false gods. And the whole empire building of Babylon had dehumanized people in many nations. People had become like fish to net, like slaves to drag away, economic commodities. So you dehumanize people. And often that happens when empires rise to become powerful. They dehumanize the people that they conquered so that it becomes easier to conquer them and deal with them, to grab their wealth. That's what the Babylonians had done. Now, how can God tolerate this? How can God, who made humans in his own image, use people to bring judgment as his instruments who treat people like this? And atheists like Richard Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens often hurl their accusations against God. How can God allow this sort of thing? If there is a God, why doesn't he stop suffering? And they use them as reasons not to believe in God. What they don't realize, or maybe they do, but they don't give any hint of it, is that God's people have been doing the same for thousands of years. God's people have actually come before God and say, why are you doing this? Why are you allowing this? Why don't you do something? God's people have done this for thousands of years. And it's an expression of their faith. This is the God who rules the universe. Therefore, why do you allow this to happen? Because they're struggling with their doubts. Well, it's at the cross where we see something of the reconciliation of this. It's the cross that gives us the full display, first of all, of God's character. If you want to see clearly what God is like, then you look at the cross. Because at the cross, you see God's unchanging eternal plan. And 1 Peter 1:18-20 tells us this. For you know that it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your forefathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. He was chosen before the creation of the world, but was revealed in these last times for your sake. When did God decide to send his Son? When was God's plan of the cross made? Before the creation of the world. Before Adam and Eve sinned. God's plan is eternal. It's unchanging. He was not caught by surprise by Adam and Eve's sin. It's the cross which shows us God's total commitment to his people. Look at Romans 8:32. And this is absolutely wonderful, one of the pearls in the Bible. He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? If God didn't spare his own son, his own beloved son, if he didn't hold back from giving him, do you think he'll hold back giving you what you need each day? Giving what's good for you each day? No, of course not. He gave his son, and so he is totally committed to his people, and he is sovereign over his plan. Nothing can stop him carrying out his plan, and he uses even the evil of people. Look at Acts 4:27-28. Indeed, Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. They did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen. Herod was carrying out his own plan. Pontius Pilate was carrying out his own plan. The religious leaders had their own plan. But God was using it all to carry out his salvation. So it's at the cross where we see the full display of God's character, his love, his justice and mercy, his compassion and righteousness, his power and humility, his wisdom and grace. But it's also at the cross where we see most clearly God, if I can put it like this, embracing evil. Crucifixion is one of the cruelest forms of execution ever devised by humans. It was devised to give maximum suffering to the victim. It was intensely cruel. And God uses this form of intense torture to bring about salvation. God himself suffers this intense execution. Not only that, Jesus, the perfect, spotless one, is made sin. Now, to me, that is the most perplexing thing. How can God and sin be brought together? How is that possible? Jesus, the perfect, spotless one, be made sin. So he takes your sin and my sin and the sin of the world on himself. That's inconceivable that that should happen. And yet that's what happens at the cross. Just look at 2 Corinthians 5:21. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. And then Jesus drinks the cup of God's wrath, his judgment against sin and evil. And the 3 hours of darkness I think, gives us some idea of what Jesus was suffering as he was hanging on the cross. He was suffering hell. He was experiencing the judgment of God against sin. So it's as if he was in hell. And no wonder he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? This is how God deals with evil. So that even though we struggle to understand, how can you be associated with evil? It's as if God takes it into himself. And he experiences the terrible suffering of evil and the punishment against evil. And he deals with it. Well, as we finish, we need to be those who have a real but sometimes perplexed faith. And so I would encourage you to begin the journey of faith. You were created to go on a journey of faith with God. That's why you were created. That's why Jesus died, so that you could begin that journey. That's why the Holy Spirit comes to help us as we go on that journey of faith. We need to remind ourselves of rock-solid certainties. Somebody has said that the essence of wisdom is to talk to yourself, not to listen to yourself. All too often we listen to ourselves so that doubts come into our mind. All sorts of things that people say fill our minds, and we listen to ourselves. Our feelings go up and down, and we're listening to ourselves. And we need to talk to ourselves, like the psalmists do again and again. They say, my soul, listen. And then they say something about God. And so we need to remind ourselves, God is the eternal creator and redeemer. My assurance is based on what he has done, not on how I feel or what I've achieved. The Spirit is with me, is God with me. And I have a glorious destiny. And somebody else has said, never doubt in the dark what God has told you in the light. So in other words, get hold of these rock-solid foundations to your faith before things start to go wrong. Because if you wait for things to go wrong, you won't have that rock-solid foundation to be able to go through that storm. So never doubt in the dark what God has told you in the light. And then lastly, be real and honest. One of the issues around faith is people feeling they have to pretend. Pretend that things are not as bad. They're not too bad. Pretend that things have happened that haven't actually happened. And so somehow we've got to pretend as if we've got to help God out in some way. Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. That's what some believers say about faith. It's believing what you know ain't so. But sometimes we believers give them reason for saying that. Because we say this has happened, when it's obvious it hasn't happened. So there is simplistic faith, which assumes that we can live without struggles, without questions, without doubt. And so A, which is the problem, plus B, which is faith, equals C, which is my solution. I have a problem, I come in prayer to God, and automatically the solution comes. That's simplistic faith, because sometimes it doesn't quite work out like that. Philip Yancey, in one of his books, talks about his father, who was going to go as a missionary to Africa. And then he was paralyzed by polio, and he was put into an iron lung machine. And many people started praying for him. And they said, well, God is going to heal you. And he believed that as well. And so he said, well, I need to get out of this iron lung machine because God is going to heal me and I'm going to go to Africa. And they took him out and he died. You see, simplistic faith says, God is going to heal you. Because you've prayed, many people have prayed, and so automatically you're going to be healed. It didn't happen. Whereas simple faith says, A, the problem, B, faith, you come to God and you pray, equals D, God's solution. Now, it might be unexpected. It might be something different. But God's solution is the best solution. And that's what Paul found. He came to God with his thorn in the flesh. And again he comes to God. Please remove it. And then he realizes, no, God has a different way. And God's strength was made perfect in his weakness. And so simple faith comes to God even as we come with our questions. Sometimes when our faith is tested, we come through and it's much deeper. And the book of Job and Habakkuk and Paul are examples of that. They come through with their faith deepened. You know, when you're pretending before God, you're foolish. Because God sees what you're like, and you're pretending you have this strong faith. You don't have any doubt. No, God sees your heart. He sees your mind. You're being foolish. It's also destructive. Because when you don't receive the answer, you begin to doubt God. And then you pray about something else, and you don't receive that answer, and then you begin to doubt again. And it's destructive. But also, it's very draining. Because it's down to me. I've got to keep up this strong faith. I've got to say, no, so-and-so has been healed. Although I can see the evidence that they haven't been healed, I've got to somehow keep up this strong faith. And it's very draining. And we need to have the attitude of the man who came with his son to Jesus. His son had a spirit, an unclean spirit. And he says, please help me. And Jesus says, do you believe? And he says, yes, Lord, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. You see, he had faith. But he also had that struggle, that doubt, those questions. And that's how we need to be before God. Any questions?
What practical steps can I take when God himself doesn't seem real anymore, where my prayers seem unanswered, my doubts have the upper hand?
Where God doesn't seem to be real anymore, and where the doubts seem to have the upper hand. I think that's where we need each other. Because if we're just on our own, we're going to struggle. There are times when we're going to just struggle. And so we need to come like this, but also sometimes maybe just to a small group of people and express those questions we have, those doubts we have, and receive encouragement from other people. The worst thing we can do is to cut ourselves off from God's people. That's the worst thing we can do. The worst thing we can do is to stop reading our Bible. To stop praying. That's the worst thing. Sometimes it takes time before suddenly the fire begins to glow again and then becomes a fire. But we need God's Spirit to just blow on it, blow on that fire. And I believe that comes as we read His Word, as we pray, as we come with God's people.
Right, thank you. Are there any others? Have we got any more questions?
Harold, I think this is a difficult subject, and I think you're dealing with it excellently. But in the hearts and minds of many, there may be a question something like this. If you can give an answer to it, I think it will help us all. Do you remember the occasion when the Lord said to his disciples, If you have faith as much as a grain of mustard seed, you can say to this hill or this mountain, be removed, and it will be removed. Could you explain in the context of what you were dealing with this morning, what an answer to that particular imperative might be?
Well, I think when we come to God, often our faith is like a grain of mustard seed. It is very small. And when we pray about a particular thing which we see as a mountain, we might expect that that will immediately be removed. So taking the example of Paul, the mountain for him was his thorn in the flesh. So he was expecting that the thorn in the flesh would be removed, and the mountain is removed. But in fact, the mountain was removed, but in a different way than he was expecting, so that he was given strength in his weakness, so that his weakness was not a problem anymore. It's as if the mountain had been diminished because he saw how big God was. The God was sufficient for what he was going through. And so sometimes it's not a question of removing the problem, but it's breaking the problem small in relationship with how big God is.